The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodkey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double November-December 2023 issue. We begin with our cover story, Tutankhamun's Treasures. The artifacts from Tut's tomb have been recorded and repaired and poked, prodded, and photographed since their discovery over a century ago. Today, scientists are still digging through their secrets. In 1922, a team of archaeologists led by Howard Carter stumbled across the final resting place of Tutankhamun, a historically unimportant pharaoh who happened to be buried alongside the biggest, best preserved stash of ancient Egyptian artifacts ever found. Since then, Tut has become one of the most recognizable rulers in Egypt's history, while his treasures, ranging from golden masks to glittering daggers, have gained their own rich reputations. And they're only getting richer. Even today, the Egyptologists who study these objects uncover surprising evidence that they were swapped, stolen, and even sourced from far-flung extraterrestrial settings. A multi-pharaoh mask. Over 100 years ago, a British archaeologist stood on the cliffs of Egypt's Valley of the Kings, around 3 miles northwest of Luxor. Since antiquity, 61 of the site's ancient tombs had been identified and exhumed. Experts assumed that they had exhausted the area, leaving nothing left to unearth. But the 48-year-old archaeologist, Howard Carter, sensed otherwise, emboldened by earlier discoveries bearing the name of a pharaoh whose body had yet to be found. Carter was right, and on November 4, 1922, he and his team identified a stairway leading down to a tomb door. After years of excavation, they reached the tomb's inner chamber and found a mummified pharaoh adorned with a gleaming golden mask. At the time of the discovery, archaeologists didn't know much about the pharaoh, a boy who took the name of Tutankhamun and ruled Egypt for around a decade. Over a century later, they still struggled to piece together his history, including the details of his death. But recent research into Tut's mask, the most iconic item found inside the tomb, has started to fill in the gaps. The ancient Egyptians believed in sending the deceased to the afterlife with items they would need to thrive, including food, furniture, and clothing. Tutankhamun's tomb was packed with these presents, which remained mostly untouched for more than 3,200 years. While the tomb appears to have been robbed twice within a few years of its initial closure in 1323 BC, its chambers were restored and sealed, albeit shoddily, in the aftermath of the thefts. The tomb itself seems small in comparison to the others in the valley. One curious thing about Tutankhamun's tomb is its size, says Nicholas Reeves, an Egyptologist and former curator for the British Museum and Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's tiny, yet it took Carter's team almost a decade to work through the handful of rooms, including the outer corridor and chambers, the antechamber and the annex, the burial chamber and the treasury. In total, the team identified over 5,000 artifacts that had been heaped into haphazard piles before the tomb was sealed. Within the burial chamber, Tutankhamun's mummy was surrounded by a series of 4 shrines, a stone sarcophagus, and 3 coffins. When these trappings were removed, Carter found the ruler wore a finely modeled funeral mask. Weighing about 22 pounds and portraying a pharaoh in striped regalia, the solid gold accessory symbolized Tut's authority over Egypt. Since its discovery, the funeral mask has become the quintessential image of Tutankhamun. But in recent years, Reeves has exposed evidence that the mask was never even intended for Tut, indicating that the pharaoh died suddenly without proper preparation. Despite this current celebrity, Tutankhamun wasn't especially impressive to the Egyptians of his era. Taking the throne as a boy of only 9 or 10 years old, Tut's private affairs and public achievements were of little consequence, even in antiquity. Following his funeral, his life and legacy were forgotten, says Reeves, whose book about the pharaoh, The Complete Tutankhamun, was revised and republished in January. Though Tutankhamun's parentage is still debated, experts have used a combination of tomb inscriptions and genetic analyses to tentatively identify one of Tut's predecessors, Akhenaten, and his father, as his father, ruling around 1353 to 1336 BC, Akhenaten was widely resented for forcing his people to trade their traditional polytheism for a strange form of sun-focused monotheism. After Akhenaten's death, the throne may have passed to Nefertiti, the deceased pharaoh's principal wife, before transferring to Tutankhamun. Because of his youth, regents ruled on his behalf, restoring old traditions in a campaign that continued after Tut's death in 1323 BC. Egyptologists still aren't sure how Tutankhamun died. Theories have ranged from a brutal bludgeoning to a chariot accident, though both possibilities have fallen out of favor. In 2010, researchers proposed that the pharaoh's parents were siblings, probably contributing to the genetic disorders identified in their son. According to the researchers, one of these disorders, a vascular bone necrosis, left Tut prone to injury with a leg fracture and malarial infection, likely sending him to the world of the dead. A separate analysis confirmed his inbred parentage in 2010. But whatever the cause of death, the body of the then 19-year-old was buried, according to tradition, deep in the Valley of the Kings. Following their removal and restoration, the bulk of the artifacts from Tutankhamun's tomb were transferred to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, where they sat for almost a century, whenever they weren't touring the world. In 2015, museum curators adjusted some displays, repositioning and relighting the mask to reveal the underside of its descriptions. Published that same year in the Journal of Ancient Egyptian Interconnections, Reeves' analysis of the impressions found that another name, potentially that of Nefertiti, had originally appeared on the mask, only to be replaced by Tut's before the tomb's sealing. There is no question that the mask had originally been made for someone else, Reeves said. And when considered with the other objects from the tomb with similar signs of appropriation, the mask suggests the pharaoh died without warning, requiring royal artisans to alter already made items in their rush to arrange the funeral. Tutankhamun's death came as a shock, Reeves says, with no preparations for his burial yet having begun. According to Reeves, at least 80% of the tomb's required burial equipment was recycled. Even the tomb itself seems to have been intended for another occupant, with its left-facing orientation reminiscent of a tomb for a queen. The tomb has been adapted, and on more than one occasion, says Reeves, who wrote a series of papers from 2015 to 2020, that the original occupant may still reside in a secret inner section of the tomb. Whether or not that theory holds true, archaeologists agree that the trappings of the pharaoh all hold their own hidden histories. The complexities of Tutankhamun's tomb have been overlooked for a century, Reeves says. Only now are we beginning to look beyond the gold and treat the materials in a rigorous, forensic manner. The results so far show that there always is more to be said about even the seemingly most hackneyed of finds. Tut resurrected. The opening of Tutankhamun's tomb and the announcement of its treasures through sensationalized news stories and striking photos gave the pharaoh another chance to rule. No greater archaeological revelations could be summoned from history, announced a New York Times article during the first season of The Dig, than is told by the mute objects in this tomb of King Tutankhamun, mute objects that speak with golden eloquence and whose message is now being revealed to the world. Inspiring everything from film and fashion to architecture and advertisement, Tut had a hold on the culture of the 1920s. And his influence endured through subsequent decades, sustained by the traveling exhibitions of his treasures that began in the 1960s. On these tours, millions of museum visitors from New York to Tokyo meandered through darkened corridors, crammed with artifacts and arranged in general approximations of the tomb. Gazing upon the pharaoh's mask and assorted mementos, the visitors viewed the objects almost as if they were part of the original excavation. As recently as 2019, 150 artifacts from the tomb were ogled by a record-breaking 1.4 million museum visitors in Paris. After a brief trip to London, these objects were then transferred to their new facilities in the Grand Egyptian Museum in Cairo, anticipated to open in late 2023 or early 2024. An otherworldly weapon. For thousands of years, a dagger sat dormant and dusty in the depths of Tutankhamun's tomb. With a golden grip dripping in gemstones and an iron blade forged from an ancient meteorite, the weapon would remain magnificent throughout its time in the darkness and would mystify researchers for decades following its discovery. It's easy to see why researchers might be confused. The art of iron smelting, or melting and manipulating iron ore, is thought to have appeared in the Near East around 1200 BC, some 120 years after the sealing of the tomb. If smelting was off the table, how might the dagger have been made? The late Takafumi Matsui, then president of the Chiba Institute of Technology in Japan, visited the weapon at the Egyptian Museum in 2020 to find out. A number of manufacturing processes are possible, he and his colleagues wrote in Meteoritics and Planetary Science in 2022, such as cold working, in which an iron meteorite is cut and polished, hot working, involving high temperature melting and subsequent casting, or low temperature heating and subsequent forging. Ultimately, the chemical and archaeological analyses by Matsui and his colleagues cast doubt on whether the weapon was crafted in Egypt. Instead, they present the possibility that the king of the nearby Mitanni Empire gave the dagger to Tutankhamun's grandfather as a wedding gift. Many prehistoric iron artifacts are known to have been forged from meteorites. But while scientists have suspected the cosmic source of iron in the pharaoh's dagger since the 1970s, it wasn't confirmed until a team analyzed its elemental composition for the first time in 2016. Though historical artifacts made from earth-based iron contain less than 4% nickel, the team found that the blade's high nickel concentration was instead consistent with space rock. 4 years later, Matsui and his colleagues used X-ray fluorescence, which determines an object's material makeup, to map the elements on the surface of the blade, not just iron and nickel, but also cobalt, chlorine, and manganese, among others. They found that the bumpy black spots on the blade's surface likely originated from troilite, a sulfur-filled mineral often found in iron meteorites, though the traces of sulfur were mostly lost after being heated to 1300 degrees Fahrenheit. The alignment of these elements proved just as informative as their abundance. Discontinuous banded arrangements were found on the surface of the weapon, according to the authors of the 2022 study. This three-dimensional texture, known as a Vidmanstätten pattern, appears in meteorites when their iron-nickel concoctions cool and separate into bands, meaning that the blade was probably never heated above 1700 degrees Fahrenheit. Using the process of elimination, the researchers threw both cold working and hot working out the window. These lines of evidence lead to a conclusion that the Tutankhamun iron blade was made by low temperature heat forging, Matsui and his colleagues write. But they had yet to solve the mystery of the weapon's maker. The team turned next to the dagger's decorated hilt, adorned with gold and lapis lazuli, a deep blue gemstone. In Tutankhamun's time, Egyptians used organic glues to gild their treasures. But high amounts of calcium on the dagger handle suggest its artisans used a stronger adhesive, lime plaster, composed of calcium oxide lime and water, sand and water. Much like smelting, the use of lime plaster arose in Egypt after Tutankhamun's death, but both were already prevalent in Mitanni to the north, suggesting that the weapon was given to the Egyptians as a gift from a neighboring realm. The 3,400-year-old Amarna letters, considered to be some of the world's oldest documents of diplomacy, support this idea. Comprising hundreds of communications between Egyptian pharaohs and nearby kings, The letters contain a list of gifts, including an iron dagger with an inlay of genuine lapis lazuli that the king of Mitanni supposedly sent to Tutankhamun's grandfather, Amenhotep III, when the pharaoh married a Mitanni princess. Though the puzzle's pieces seem to have fallen perfectly into place, only future research can confirm whether the heirloom mentioned in the letters is indeed the same heirloom sitting in the Egyptian Museum. Until then, researchers can celebrate the fact that the tomb's contents were nothing short of out of this world. Ancient, lost, and found. When Howard Carter and his team removed the first item, a small painted box, from Tutankhamun's tomb in December 1922, they'd only scratched the surface of the treasures contained within. Thousands of artifacts, from shimmering statues to sandals, were carried from its interior to be cataloged, conserved, swathed in packing paper, and sent to the Egyptian Museum. But some of these items never made it to Cairo. They disappeared during the decade-long excavation, only to turn up today in museum collections and auction sites across the U.S. and Europe. The only logical explanation, experts say, is that they were diverted by none other than Carter himself. Within 1 month of the identification of the tomb steps, Carter and his team had cleared the stairs of debris and breached the door of Tutankhamun's tomb. Thus began the daunting task of recording and removing the thousands of treasures inside. To start, the members of the team took photos of the artifacts in the tomb. They then transported those items to a nearby archaeology studio, where they were classified, conserved, and photographed further, before being transported to Cairo, as was required by Egyptian law. Egyptologists have long suspected that Carter pocketed several items during this process, but the identity and location of many of these items have remained elusive. Now, by comparing photographs from the tomb with photographs from museums and auctions, researchers have identified several pieces of Tutankhamun's jewelry that had been taken by Carter, according to a presentation by French Egyptologist Marc Gabold at the Centennial Tutankhamun Conference in November 2022. Identified in various states of disarray, some pieces of jewelry were dismantled, while other pieces were disassembled and reassembled in anachronistic arrangements with beads added or omitted. Among Gabold's finds are the hawk-headed terminals and teardrop beads of a broad collar, which Carter stripped from Tutankhamun's corpse in 1926 and subsequently passed to friends or family. While the golden terminals were eventually purchased from an art collector by the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Missouri, the teardrop beads made their way to private auction, and similar stories have surfaced for other tomb accessories, too, according to Gabold. We have seen that not all of the jewelry found on Tutankhamun's mummy went to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, Gabold, who teaches at the Paul Valéry University of Montpellier, writes in a self-published preprint about the research from 2018. Carter kept some pieces for himself, and these are now on display in various museums. Carter's motivations for the thefts remain unclear. It's possible, Gabold says, that the archaeologist saw the jewelry as partially his own and thus free for the taking. It's also possible that the archaeologist brought the artifacts back to Britain for further analysis, only to find himself harboring stolen antiquities. I suppose that he would have felt trapped, Gabold says, of this possibility. The only way was to keep these objects. Though the motives remain a mystery, Gabold says that further investigations could reveal additional artifacts in the future. Recognition of relevant pieces is complicated, Gabold writes in the preprint, but there is good reason to hope that more lost pieces from Tutankhamun's tomb will ultimately resurface. From cats to chatbots, non-humans are authoring scientific papers. Researchers have long practiced honorary authorship, but the rise of artificial intelligence is making it even easier. Though proving to be a daydream tool for many industries, ChatGPT is quickly becoming a nightmare for academia. As of January 2023, four separate research papers have cited the AI chatbot as a co-author in a research project, forcing scientific journals to scramble to update their policies and regulations addressing possible ethical problems. The process of adding an author who made little to no contribution to a scientific paper is called honorary authorship, and it's caused some serious ethical issues in the past. One of the earliest of these occurred in the mid-1970s and involved, surprisingly, a cat. In 1975, Jack Hetherington, a University of Michigan physics professor, had just finished writing an influential paper on changing particle behaviors at different temperatures. The paper was due to be published in Physics Review Letters, and the deadline was looming. Unfortunately, a colleague pointed out a problem. Hetherington had referred to himself as "we" in the paper, yet he was the only author, which could cause the paper to be rejected. So instead of retyping the whole paper, Hetherington simply added the name of his cat, a Siamese called Chester, as a co-author. In an anthology book by author R. L. Weber, Hetherington explains that he created Chester's pseudonym, F.D.C. Willard, by adding Felix Domesticus, the Latin name for domestic cats, in front of Chester's first initial. Then Hetherington slapped Chester's father's name, Willard, on as a surname. I did not ignore the publicity value, Hetherington admits in the book. If it eventually proved to be correct, people would remember the paper more if the anomalous authorship were known. Hetherington's theory turned out to be correct. Not only did the paper become widely cited, but eventually the world found out about Chester's authorship, arousing even more publicity. While the University of Michigan leveraged this attention, even offering Chester a faculty position as a distinguished visiting fellow, others were not as thrilled. The editors at Physics Review Letters, for one, felt misled and silly for publishing a paper co-authored by a cat. The ethical controversy was mostly overlooked at the time, however, and Chester went on to co-author two more papers and one solo paper before passing away in 1982 at the age of 14. To honor Chester's legacy, on April 1, 2014, the American Physical Society announced an open access initiative for all cat-authored papers. Chester's story is just one of a handful in which scientists have added a pet or animal test subject as a co-author. Nobel Prize-winning physicist André Geim co-authored a paper with an author suspiciously named H.A.M.S. Tertricia. While the paper did not disclose Trisha's contributions, Geim still was able to add the pet hamster as an honorary author. Others have not been as lucky. Immunologist Polly Matzinger published a paper with her dog, Galadriel Mirkwood, as an honorary author in the Journal of Experimental Immunology in 1978. Upon finding out the truth, the journal's editor banned Matzinger from the publication until that editor died and a new one was appointed. Matzinger also became the subject of an internal investigation at the University of California, San Diego, as a result. Luckily, she was able to show that her dog had indeed contributed to her research and that no fraud had been committed. Regardless of whether these animal collaborators are test subjects or simply pets, Hans-Rundi Lenz of the University of Würzburg in Germany argues this practice is unethical. Logically, a pet or deceased relative cannot make a genuine and identifiable contribution to a scientific publication, he says. The whimsy of these stories can easily obstruct the ethical dilemmas they cause. Yet the process of honorary authorship, even beyond pets, continues, thanks to the pressure scientists feel to continually publish. In a 2020 study, psychologist Mariola Paruzel-Zaczura of the University of Silesia in Poland and her colleagues found that the most common form of scientific misconduct reported is honorary authorship. It could be some kind of bribe, Paruzel-Zaczura says, offering a few possible reasons for the prevalence of the practice. It could help a researcher get a better job or funding for a conference. It could even be a partnership where both researchers agree to add each other as honorary authors. This, however, causes problems with authorship inflation, in which an author's number of citations is higher than it should be because they seem to have published more papers. Now, thanks to the rise of artificial intelligence and all that comes with it, we're looking at you, ChatGPT, it's even easier for researchers to practice honorary co-authorship. Because of this, most scholarly journals are finding it more difficult to regulate AI co-authors. We are trying to make the most cautious approach that we can, says H. Holden Thorpe, the editor-in-chief of Science. We'll start with something more restrictive and then loosen it up over time. In a January 2023 Science editorial, Thorpe cites a couple of these policy changes, including a complete ban on the use of any part of the text, images, figures, or graphics made by ChatGPT or other AI tools. Thorpe, like others, hopes that the National Academy of Sciences will address this issue soon in order to set the precedent of dealing with an AI honorary author. One possible path forward may come from a paper published in 2017 by researchers from the University of Cologne in Germany. The authors write, "The appropriate way of considering others' factual role in scientific publications should generally be in the acknowledgement section." The researchers then went in to thank their goldfish, Einstein and Heisenberg, in this very section. The not-so-northern lights. These milky swirls of chartreuse, purple, red, and blue are commonplace in Alaska, Canada, and Scandinavia. This year, however, the ethereal northern lights have made appearances in dozens of the lower 48 U.S. states, even dancing across dark skies as far south as Arizona last spring. And you can expect similar spectacular shows over the next few years. That's due in part to an 11-year cycle within our sun's atmosphere. Essentially, every 11 years, the solar magnetic field temporarily collapses, or looks like a bowl of spaghetti for a while, according to space physicist Don Hampton of the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, then reverses. This cyclical shift is forecast to peak in late 2024 to 2025, bringing an influx of solar storms, flares, and the coronal mass ejections of particles that cause the aurora borealis, or aurora australis, in the southern hemisphere. As the charged particles reach our atmosphere, they gravitate towards the magnetic poles and emit a shower of color when they collide with nitrogen and oxygen. The solar drama over the next couple of years bodes well for the usual global hotspots and for locations like the lower 48 that don't typically experience the celestial show. Trashy tides. Tethered to self-made floats of trapped air and mucus, Janthina sea snails follow the flow of the ocean all the way to a swirling muddle twice the size of Texas, spotted with plastic debris. That's where researchers found them when they sailed more than 300 nautical miles to arrive at the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in 2019. Sampling the surface of the patch, which forms where many ocean currents meet in the northern Pacific, the team found a surprising concentration of drifting creatures, including the jellyfish-esque tentacled blue button and by-the-wind sailors, oval-shaped organisms with distinctive sails for gliding along ocean currents. Reporting their results in PLOS Biology in 2023, the researchers say the currents create a space for floating organisms to mate and share meals, but not apart from the trash, but alongside it. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.